Right, morning everyone. last time, for those that were here, I dealt with the creation-evolution issue and how the evidence was stacked, scientific evidence was stacked completely against the evolutionary scenario, which leaves us with the fact that God created the heavens and earth and life. Now, I presented quite a negative argument in some ways against evolution. Now today I'm going to present some evidence which is for creation. And that is, I'm going to deal with something of the technical aspects of the ear and the eye to show you how it could not have evolved and God must have created it. So this will be a semi-technical presentation. But I'm going to go through the stuff fairly quickly, okay, just to give you an overview to show you how wonderful, in a sense, God's creative power is and how superbly engineered the ear and the eye are, made by a genius, above geniuses, seriously. Right, and so I'm going to start off with the human ear. Now, I'm going to have to go through this material fairly quickly because I've got two to do in one session. I didn't want to drag them out, so here goes. So, the human ear. Now, I'm going to give a little background about sound, first of all, and then go into something of the structure of the ear and just give you some insight as to how it works and how it could not have evolved. Right. We hear sounds from about 20 hertz, that's 20 vibrations every second, right up to 20,000. Quite a wide range, in fact. And we say that the human range is from 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz. And the 20 hertz being the deep bass, and the 20 hertz, very high treble, but I can't get up there these days. we are most sensitive to sounds in the 2 to 3K region, and much less sensitive to high treble and bass sounds. And the wonderful thing about our hearing is we can detect an incredible range of sound levels from something which is almost undetectable, almost down to what we call the thermal noise, right up to thunder and explosions. It's really amazing, the ear. So what is sound? Well, any surface that vibrates in air produces sound waves. That's how we produce sound. Loudspeakers produce sound. They just vibrate, and then the sound wave travels away from the cone of the loudspeaker as it vibrates. That's how sound is made, okay? And that loudspeaker down there is a B&W Kevlar cone mid-bass driver, for those who want to know. the sound waves go like that. Now, I used to teach A-level physics students, as probably most of you are aware, and I always used to put that up for them when I talked to them about sound. And I said, well, there's a sound wave moving through air, you can see, and I said, focus on one of the particles, because you'll see all the particles move backwards and forwards, but the actual system, the wave system, travels along. Fascinating. I just thought you'd like to see that. Where the particles are close together, or the air molecules are, that's where you get the little high-pressure regions which travel away from the source. So that's what a sound wave is. Fascinating, isn't it? It's called a longitudinal wave. The ear, then. I was just thinking, would it be possible to put these fluorescents off the array, just to get a bit more contrast on the screen? I did last week, and I forgot. These here. You'll get them in a minute. That's the one, yes. You get a little better, thanks. Get a bit better contrast on the diagram there. Right. Now, I'm going to look at how the ear detects these vibrations very quickly. So there's just a quick overview of the ear. You've got the outer ear with what we call our ear, and then the ear canal going in. You've got the eardrum, the little bones inside, and then you've got that's the middle ear, and the inner ear with the cochlea and those little semicircular canals. That's a schematic of the ear. Fascinating. But the one I like, the diagram I like, that's just labelled up for you so that you know some of the men, don't worry if you don't take this in, but anyway. And that's a nicer diagram, which is almost a sort of 3D rendered diagram of the ear, which I think is particularly nice. So what happens when sound, I'll just give you an overview, then I'll deal with it in a little more detail quickly. So sound waves come in the ear. Now they are directed via what we call our ears. They're funneled in down through the ear canal. If we didn't have an ear canal and we scratched our ear, we'd rupture the eardrum. So it's got to be inside the head. Okay. There are other reasons why we have this ear canal, which I'll come on to in just a moment, acoustic reasons. Then the sound waves come in here. They make the eardrum vibrate. The vibrations are transferred to this malleus bone there, which is directly connected to the incus bone, and that rocks and then makes that little bone there push on the cochlea there, and the vibrations go into the cochlea and they're detected, which I'll come on to later. Okay, so that's the basic operation of the ear. There are some very good engineering reasons why the ear has to be designed this way. Alright? You couldn't just have a sound detecting organ on the outside like the cochlea. It wouldn't work. And I'll explain that in just a moment. So, what's that? Will it come off? Will it go off again?
Yeah, okay.
Sorry. Right. Now I'm going to go through each of the parts of the ear just as quickly as I can and show you how they work and then give you an overview as to why all the bits are necessary and why it has to be designed that way. And then I'll talk about why it could not have evolved at all. Right. So, wrong way. Right. The outer ear, first of all. The sound waves go into the ear. See the little arrow there? Yeah? And they go to the eardrum. Then they strike the eardrum and some of the wave is reflected. Just like that. And this reflected wave actually combines with the incoming wave to create a resonance at around 3.7 kilohertz, 3 or 4 kilohertz, 3 or 4,000 cycles a second. And that gives our ears a very good sensitivity in that region. Because it has an almost, inverted commas, an amplifying effect on the sound. Not only that in the ear, but the design, the sort of funnel design of the ear actually gives acoustic gain, just like the horns you used to see people wearing. And that actually helps to concentrate the sound pressure as it goes into the ear. And combined with that resonance gives us extreme sensitivity around those middle frequencies. And that's, for the technically minded, that's a low Q quarter wave resonance, okay? So, you know. Right. Now, the sound hits the eardrum, and it obviously bounces off it, but also it makes it vibrate like that, okay? At lowish frequencies, it's like the top diagram, and at slightly higher frequencies, it does go into a complex resonance, but only at higher frequencies. Normal frequencies, it is vibrating more or less, as you see on the top diagram. And the vibration is obviously matches the incoming frequency. And this vibration is transferred to the middle ear. And in the middle ear are these bones, as you can see there. That's a nice diagram. I don't know if the next one's any better. I'll use this one. The eardrum vibrates and it makes these bones rock, and this one is articulated there and it pushes onto the cochlea. Now, you might say, well, why is all that fiddly mechanism necessary? Well, it is very necessary. Let me get onto the diagram. That's another diagram. I'll come onto that slide in a minute. You can see on that diagram how intricately designed those bones are, with the suspensory ligaments there in strategically placed, and there are some muscles there which tend to clamp it up when we hear very loud sounds to act as an automatic volume control, which I'll come on to later. That's another nice diagram of the bones. You see that the, that little bone there is fixed onto sort of the top half of the eardrum, and so when the eardrum vibrates, that can rock just like that. And that lever does that, and then that articulated joint just pushes in and out like a sort of piston onto the cochlea, like that. And there's a little a rough diagram of it, an animation. Okay? Now, why are those bones necessary? Now, this goes on to some quite advanced physics. If I clap my hands, the sound wave will go to that wall and it will bounce off. Give no energy to the wall. If you clap your hands above water, most of the sound energy will come back up again and not go into the water. And that's because of the huge difference in density of the water compared with air and the compressibility. Okay? Now, the cochlea in our ear is filled with liquid similar to water. If we have the cochlea just on the outside of the head, all that happens is the sound waves will come and hit it and bounce off. And due to the small area that it's actually got, very little sound energy will go in. So, the bones of the middle ear are what the engineers would call an acoustic transformer. What they actually do is to allow the use of a larger area eardrum. The vibrations from that are passed through to a much smaller area on the cochlea, and the force that was pushing in and out on the eardrum is therefore concentrated on a much smaller area and therefore is able to push the fluid backwards and forwards in the cochlea and enable the sound to be detected. It's about a 15-to-1 gain in area. And it's absolutely necessary to have that acoustic transformer in the ear for us to be sensitive to sound. If that weren't the case, we wouldn't be able to hear sensitively at all. Okay, and this is where you start to think, and that evolved, that intricate system of bones evolved. How can a system like that evolve? Because you can't get it all evolving at once. You might get the bones, you might get the ligaments, you might get the eardrum. You can't have it all at once, the intricate mechanism. You know, this is where you start to realise that the evolutionary scenario breaks down and crumbles into dust. You can't evolve intricately designed acoustic systems like that. It's just not possible. So, that's one of the little animations you get. So the eardrum vibrates, and those vibrations squidge fluid down the cochlea. I'll come to that in a moment. Okay? Fascinating. An acoustic transformer. And the nice thing is about the design of the bones, because the eardrum's like that, when it vibrates, it rocks that bone, and that rocks that assembly. See, it's quite a cunning bit of engineering there. Quite a cunning bit of engineering. And it encourages it to oscillate in what we call the fundamental mode, all at once, rather than going to break up. It's a very, very clever little bit of design there. Very clever. I couldn't have done better myself. Sorry. And you see you've got the little muscles there which can contract when things get a bit loud and actually dumb down our hearing a bit. So that's an automatic volume control inside. But it's just fascinating how, from an engineering, an acoustic engineering point of view, this has been put together. It really is. The other thing is, of course, we've got the ear passage that protects our eardrum. It also stops water getting in and damage to the eardrum and has the resonance and the funneling effect. It's all a nice integrated design. Right, down the middle ear, haven't I? I've shown you how that works. Now, middle ear muscles, I'll skip over that because I've mentioned it. The middle ear muscles are an automatic volume control. So I'll skip that because I'm short of time. Now the cochlea, that's where the sound is actually detected. This is a fascinating organ. That's a cochlear unwind. It's about 3 or 4 centimetres if you unwind it. It's a very complex little organ, and it's very. It is not even now absolutely fully understood. It's nearly understood how it works. That's a cross-sectional view. The fluid is pushed in the cochlea. I'll have to skip that. There's a lot of it. The cochlea is shaped in a circle because it actually helps in a circular pattern because it helps to amplify the sound waves. But I'll skip over that. You can look at it on the website later. Right. What biologists miss out when they describe the ear? Very interesting. One of the keys to this acoustic design is the speeds of sound in the different media that are involved. The speed of sound in air is about 340 metres a second. Sound travels about a mile in 5 seconds. In water it's about 1.5 kilometres a second, much faster. But in bone it's about 4,000 metres a second. And what this means is that with this design of the ear, relatively slow sound waves come and hit the eardrum, but the transmission through the bone is very, very fast, and you don't get too many nasty little resonances in the bone because of the high speed of transmission, plus the extra stiffness of the bone. It means it's a very good little transmission route through to the cochlea. Now, and you actually have to use water in the cochlea because the little cells that respond to the vibrations would not respond if there was just gas in there. You've got to have liquid vibrations actuating the biological mechanisms in the cochlea. And the higher speed of sound actually means that you actually have to have quite a small cochlea, and I'll come on to that in a minute. It takes the sound wave about 23 microseconds to travel all around the cochlea, right round the loop. It's interesting. Corresponds to a frequency of, this is just ballpark figures, about 22k, which is roughly our upper limit of hearing, which is one of the features of the cochlear design, that it's designed so that the shock wave in the fluid can get round it very quickly and then go through the little gap at the end. Anyway, so it means all the fluid in the cochlea can actually move together at normal frequencies because of the speed of sound in water and the fact, which is essentially in the cochlea, and the fact that it's quite small. If it wasn't like that, we'd have real engineering problems with the hearing. Fascinating bit of design. Now, how does the cochlea actually work? Now, this is quite mind-blowing. I don't fully understand it myself, but I found out what I can. If you stretch out the cochlea, inside it, there are two liquid pathways through the cochlea, one from the eardrum, one that goes the return path, and if you stretch it out, across the middle there's a membrane. Now I'll see if I can get a diagram of that. Yeah. There's a membrane that goes across the middle. I'll skip on a bit. That's it, yes? That's a cross-section of the cochlea. The eardrum pushes on that, and it spirals, the fluid spirals round the end, a little gap in the heliocatrema, and the fluid actually can come back through the vestibular canal, and there's a little window at the end which can equalise the pressure of the round window. You can just bulge out of it. Now, what happens when the eardrum does that? It causes slow waves to travel down this centre section. The basal membrane, and that's how we hear. And what happened? That's probably the nicest diagram. And you get these slow waves travelling down here. Now, because the width and properties of this change as it goes down the cochlea, different parts of it will respond in a resonance at different frequencies. And so, different parts of the cochlea actually respond to different parts of the audible spectrum, low or high sound, with the very high frequencies at the front, and there's a reason for that, very low frequencies at the end. Okay? Like that. And I've tried to get some other diagram of the basilar membrane. You can see that's it stretched out. And you can see where the different frequencies are detected along it. Those waves travel much more slowly than the actual sound shock waves through the liquid. It's a slow wave, and they've got little sort of filaments across that actually oscillate almost like guitar strings. So if you change the width of those, you get different resonances. Yeah, like when you fret a guitar, you know, you want to play high notes, you get a short string. Exactly the same with the ear. So that's how the different frequencies are differentiated in the ear. Fascinating, isn't it? How it works. And that's the little equalising window where the fluid pressure can go back again. All this has been discovered in the last few decades. It's quite recent research that has discovered really how all this works. Right, let's get on. So that's how we detect the different frequencies. Very, very clever design. There you see, again, that cochlea. Now, inside there, and this is fascinating as well. Inside the cochlea, right in the middle, this thing called organ of Corti, which actually detects the sound waves and creates the nerve impulses that go to the brain. And in fact, there are some little amplifiers in there called the outer hair cells, which actually amplify the sound before it gets to the inner hair cells where the nerve impulses are actually produced. Fascinating. So it's got an inbuilt amplifier. That evolved, of course. Sorry, I just can't get over how any biologist with a brain could imagine that could evolve. No, you would need to develop organs such as this. You would need such a radical coding in the DNA, it could never be produced by mutations, let alone selected for in the intermediate stages. To think that that could evolve is nonsense of the highest order. It just wouldn't work. It's too complex. It's too complex an integrated organ to ever think it could be done piecemeal. And as I pointed out, without all those bits in the acoustic engineering chain, we wouldn't hear properly. You've got to have the canal for resonance, for protection. You've got to have the eardrum and the bones, the ossicles, going to as your acoustic transformer. And you've got to have this very tiny coiled cochlea with the membrane in it to detect the sound. So it's a completely integrated organ. And you can't have one bit of it. It won't work. It has no selective advantage. Evolution, no. Right. There we are. Design and function of the human ear is so complex it could not possibly have evolved. The whole system needs to be in place for hearing to function properly. But there is yet more. We need to have an auditory analysis system, and this is the other miracle of hearing. We've got to interpret what the nerves feed into our brains. What can the ear-brain system do? Identify musical notes, appreciate harmony. We can identify different musical instruments. Just think what we can do in terms of our hearing. Hear individual instruments when several are playing simultaneously, conversations in a crowded room. Our auditory analysis capability is quite amazing. Much better than computers can do. You couldn't feed an output from a microphone into a computer and say, isolate that conversation. We do it partially through eyes, partially through a number of means. Recognise speech, speech recognition as well. It's all built into our brain. And that's an integrated function as well. And that's the other thing. Irreducibly complex systems. Remember I mentioned that last time. Systems where if you have one or two bits, they won't work. You've got to have all of them. I said the conversation, locate stereo hearing. We can locate the position of a sound by various means, by echoes, by the arrival times, by the different intensities of the ears. Fascinating. And this level of auditory processing cannot be matched by any current computer system. That's stereo sound. Right. And finally, Ray to give a balance presentation. Sorry, that's a joke. We have the semicircular canals. Now, those are tacked on to our cochlea, but they're not directly connected with hearing. Now, I'll just mention them in part. These are three hollow-filled tubes next to the cochlea. They have loose particles in them and liquids, so that when we turn, the liquid tends to stay still due to its own inertia. So the little particles pick all the little nerve cells inside, and it tells us when we are rotating. Okay? Particularly when we accelerate round. Okay? So that's our rotation sensor. We use it to balance and all sorts. Yeah. So that's just tacked onto the cochlea. Very nice little design. You've got to have the three tubes, because you've got to work on the three possible rotation axes. So you've got to have three tubes. Okay? Very clever design. Very, very clever. Right, now I'll do this for a couple of minutes, then I'll go on to the eye, and I should be finished at 9:15, I hope. Right, now this is the sort of drivel that you get from evolutionists. And I've got a couple of pages, but I want you to see how these fairy stories are made up about how the ear evolved. Naturally, blah, 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 blah. It's believed that heard by picking up vibrations through the ground and water. These vibrations would be picked up by the creature's entire body, but mostly by the dense parts, such as bones. And they would reach the inner ear. The primitive inner ear contained a fluid-filled region that was surrounded by dense bone. Of course, the bones resonate, which in turn would transfer the vibration of the fluid. Tiny hairs, where do they come from? In the fluid region would convert the fluid vibration into electrical signals. How? You've seen how complex the organ of Corti is, and you can see the stories that are being made up there. It would travel through the nerves to the brain. The brain would then interpret these signals as sounds. Blah, blah, blah. So, drawing out of what that was taken straight from an article on evolution of the ear. So you've got to have a fluid-filled bone cavity, plus specialised hair cells, plus dedicated nerve pathways, plus a brain that can interpret the signals, all present at once for any rudimentary hearing. That is irreducibly complex. You cannot evolve those all at once. So it would be impossible even for a primitive ear to come into existence, because you've got to have all the parts in place for it to work, even however primitive it is. You've got to have the analytical capability, even if you've got the nerve signals. There's no point in having an ear that produces nerve impulses and what's in here can't interpret it, can't make sense of it, can't use the information in any way to provide a selective advantage, which is what evolutionists claim. Next one's, I think, just as bad. This one's wonderful. The various inner ear structures were developed from parts of the fish jaw. Now you know. Yes. Eventually, the inner ear began to change and develop. Magic. And it's probable that a small region of the inner ear, partially responsible for balance, evolved into the membrane of the upper window. See what I mean by science fiction? At the same time, the inner ear was increasing in size and complexity. Why? Did it have any selective advantage? No. In amphibians, this is wonderful, a small bulge appeared in the vestibular region of the ear. Why? As evolution proceeded, who was driving evolution? The bulge eventually developed into the spiral of cochlea. Magic!
It's all observable science.
Well, for someone who is supposedly scientific to write that drivel is contemptible. A small bulge eventually developed into the spiral of cochlea. You've seen how complex the organ is, and you've seen the drivel that evolutionary publicists write. And people swallow these lies. They're lies. They're scientific evolutionary fairy stories. I'll go on now. So, finally, I've been through that very quickly, and I do apologise. I'll get on to the islands immediately. So if you believe that all of this complex and cleverly designed organ simply evolved gradually, then to be honest, you have not understood the elegance of the biological technology or the inability of blind chance mutations to create anything. And as I said last time, only our Creator God has the power and intelligence to design and build such a wonderful sensory organ and to integrate this into our total brain information system. We are integrated organisms. Our eyes, our ears, all our senses are integrated in our brain. They work together. That's why you couldn't make us piecemeal or creatures piecemeal. We are integrated, engineered systems, biologically. There we are. That's what it says, and that's what it means. Right, I hope that was interesting. I'm sorry I skimmed through it very quickly. Right, I'm going to do the eye now. Wonderful. The eye is just as at least as interesting. Hope I've not bored you yet. Have I? Right, the eye. Now, at school, you are taught that the eye is just like a camera. Therefore, it's quite a simple organ. Oh, yes. In a camera, the lens focuses light onto a film or sensor ray. In the eye, the lens focuses light onto the retina, which has light-sensitive cells. There we are. So you get the little diagrams of the camera and the eye. The light levels in both the eye and the camera are controlled by a variable diameter iris at the front. That's what you're told, yes, to regulate the light. But the above points about the eye are misleading, and the ray diagram on the right is actually quite wrong. The eye lens doesn't do most of the focusing. It's done at the cornea at the front, which is curved. I'll come on to that. The eye is not a simple organ. It is highly complex, and it's a brilliant design. Now, that's just the basic anatomy of the eye. And that's basic. Very basic. Essentially, crunch, the light obviously comes in here. The main refraction takes place... Thanks, Steve. So I don't move. The main refraction takes place at the surface of the cornea. That acts as the primary lens of the eye, contrary to what you're often told. All right? And the eye then goes through these highly transparent tissues, through that gap there, which does open and close, through to the eye lens, which is, again, highly transparent. It is carefully shaped, but also flexible, which is very interesting. Then the light is, by means of the cornea and the eye lens, is focused back all the way around onto this curved retina, which I'll deal with the structure of in a moment, which actually detects the light. Okay? So optically, simplistically, that's how the eye works. But the lens doesn't do most of the focusing. It gives fine control to enable us to see there or to see in the distance. That's all it does, by changing shape slightly. When these muscles contract, the ciliary muscles put on those ligaments there, and they pull the lens around and change its shape, okay, to enable us to focus on things that are close. When the eye lens is relaxed, we're focused on infinity, and when those muscles start to pull on the lens, it makes us focus near two. And that's why, as we get older, as the lens material stiffens up a bit, it becomes more difficult to change the lens shape. We need to, as I do, wear reading glasses for very close work. So, there you go. Right, now, a lot has been said about the eye, and Darwin said, Darwin claimed it could have evolved, but said he thought at first sight it was difficult to see how it could happen. I agree with it. Anyway, we've got some non-human eyes there. of different creatures. And biologists have used these to try and create a fairy story as to how the eye evolved. And if you go onto Wikipedia, and... Oh, that's a lovely part. I'll just let you read that. And then I'll go on to what Wikipedia says about the eye evolution. So Darwin says the difficulty of believing that a perfect and complex eye, and he didn't know everything about it. He knew the utter basics. We know far more now about the structure and function of the eye than Darwin ever could have done. The difficulty of believing that this organ could be formed by natural selection, though insuperable by our imagination, should not be considered subversive of the theory. Evolutionary dogma, straight from the horses or Darwin's mouth. Okay?
Sorry, could you
explain?
I don't understand the last sentence.
Right. What it means is that it is difficult to believe. What he's saying is that it is difficult to believe that a perfect and complex eye could be formed by natural selection, though too much for our imagination, if you like, and super to our imagination. But this, the fact that we can't imagine how it could happen, should not be considered a criticism of the theory of evolution. That's translated. That's what it actually means. It's in 1872 speak. Okay.
Evolution is taught like that, doesn't it? So you think they're clever.
Yeah. Right. Now, I've labelled this one practical magic. And you'll understand why when I put the slide up. Now, if you Google the evolution of the eye, this is what you get. Can you see that any quickly? This comes up on Wikipedia and other websites. How the eye evolved. Is supposed to have evolved. Now, first of all, you see, what you have to have is, top left, you've got nerve fibres and photoreceptors. And that's supposed to be the primitive eye. But the problem with that is that photoreceptors, as I'll show you, are highly complex. Biochemically, they're very, very, very complex. Nerves are highly complex. Supposing you did have cells on a primitive organism that could detect light, even if they could ever evolve, which I'll show you they can't, and nerve fibres, what do you do with that information? That little creature, whatever it is, has to have a brain, and for it to evolve, the brain has to interpret the nerve pulses, make sense of what's happening and use that information to increase its survivability, or natural selection would not allow its preferential reproductive success. So that sort of primitive eye is not primitive at all. Photoreceptors are highly complex, so are nerves, and you've got to have the processing apparatus to make sense of the nerve impulses, and that has to inform what the creature does in terms of feeding, evasion of predators, whatever else, in order for it to have any survival advantage. Anyway, but it gets better. It gets better. Now, you see, when the eye started to form, what happened is, top right, you get a little cup forming. You see, just like that. Magic. Well, supposing it did. Supposing that area of tissue formed into a cup. It says on there, limited directional sensitivity. Sounds good, but it's not good. Because if you are going to have directional sensitivity, those nerve fibres then would have to differentiate quite clearly between the different regions of that cup to allow the light coming in at different angles to strike different parts of the nerve of that sensitive area. So you'd have to have complete differentiation of various regions in that cup, and that's a major change. Apart from, it's not just the shape of the cup, you have to have a change in those nerves and a change in the partitioning of those areas of tissue. Then, once you get the nerve fibres, then have to go in separate bundles or strands to the brain. Then the brain would have to change to be able to analyse that information in a completely new and much more complicated way than just light or dark, to actually make the creature to be able to process, analyse and act on that information in some way. Now, that's an irreducibly complex system. It just doesn't happen. Because you might get a change in the shape of the cut, you might get differentiation. You've got to have everything together. You've got to have the analysis capability, you've got to have the nerve bundles changed, you've got to have the cut changed, you've got to have the tissue regions there. You've got to have everything. You see? Irreducibly complex. Sorry, am I boring you yet? If I'm boring you, I'll shut up.
No,
okay. Yes, but you see, once you really think about it, it's nonsense. Because you need a set of precise changes to make that step, evolution terms, selectable. Now, it gets even better now, you see. We've got the next stage, of course, would be a water-filled chamber, with a little pinhole there. Well, it's water-filled anyway, but it may have been water-filled. And to increase the resolution. But what's being assumed there is that the aperture closes to give a sort of pinhole camera effect. But there again, you see, if the aperture closed, it would only decrease the light going in, and in order to make use of the increased resolution, you'd have to have much further differentiation of those tissue areas inside, the receptor areas inside, plus extra nerve bundles, plus, again, extra processing capability to make sense of the additional information that has been given. It all would need to be coordinated. It would need to be a coordinated change. And natural selection doesn't just select something because it might be useful in future. See, and that's why these changes couldn't evolve. And these brainless, simplistic diagrams are attempts by evolutionists to deceive people. And I don't use the word lightly. They are deception. They are simplistic, and they try to convince people that it was just a nice and easy little process for eyes to evolve. But they wouldn't. And as I go through more of it, you'll see why. And then we have the really Harry Potter moment, the magic where suddenly a lens appears. Yeah. Of the right shape, the right material, in the right place, held in place by some elementary suspensory ligaments, etc. You'd need new proteins for that, the coding for the precise shape of the lens, the coding for the suspension. Everything has to be coded in the DNA. And mutations just wouldn't do it.
Are they saying that the cornea lens gradually, over a few years
or millions of years, it changed, or straight away produce one month or whatever, and another? Well, it's not made clear when you see these little diagrams. It's just not made clear. I'm just saying that this is what is you get on Wikipedia. This is how they say the eye evolved. The detail is key, which they don't give. Otherwise, the fairy story would break down. From an evolutionary perspective, you would have to have a fully functioning lens like that. A blob that was either semi-transparent or the wrong shape would be no use. The creature would have no survival capability. You've got to have it in place, working, to have selection advantage under the evolutionary scenario. So presumably, that would have to appear Harry Potter. Whoosh! And of course, it can't. Random mutations won't produce a massive change like that. This is the problem. It just won't happen. And then it says iris and separate cornea develop. Same problem. It's just practical magic. That's really, it's as if evolution has got a magic wand. It's instant miracles.
Evolution's got its own intelligence.
Well,
it's like God.
That is. Well, you were here last week, weren't you?
Yeah.
When on the slides where you get a quote from evolutionists that it says natural selection can create their words. They impute creative power to natural selection. It's just a blind process of survivability. No foresight, no intelligence. And they say that can create. Well, it doesn't. It doesn't create anything. Right, now, just to show you, I'm not going to go through this because I'm not a biochemist. But the biochemical mechanism that turns photons of light into nerve impulses is very complex. And it's been written about by a biochemist called Michael Behe, who wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box. And he goes through this, how the mechanism has so many interdependent parts biochemically, and it's very complex. It could not have evolved by no stretch of the imagination. Don't worry about that. I don't fully understand it either. So I'm not a biochemist. But just believe me when I say that the biochemical means of photon detection is incredibly complex and incredibly sensitive as well. And it says in the article, if you've got a whole raft of different proteins needed for this mechanism to work. And as you know, proteins contain on average 300, as I said, little amino acids last time in precise sequence, folded in a precise way. And the chance of getting extra proteins randomly is zero. It really is, mathematically. Right. Now, at the back of our retina, we have sort of a structure sort of like that. That's part of it. That's what detects the light. And only in the last couple of decades have biologists and physicists realised how the retina properly works. Now, one of the criticisms Richard Dawkins levelled and other evolutionists against the creation of the eye by God, is they said, well, it's wired backwards. You see, you've got the nerve cells are at the top where the light has to go through. God would never have designed it that way now, would he? Well, yes, he would have done. And for very good reason. The rod and cone cells at the very back of the retina, these that detect the light, need a good blood supply because they have to process the chemicals inside quite quickly to refresh our visual capability. So they need a very good blood supply. And you don't want thick blood vessels in the way of the light. So they've got to go at the back. Therefore, from an engineering point of view, you have to have the nerve cells over the front of the eye where the light actually has to go through the nerve cells. But in fact it doesn't, because the eye has been designed. It didn't evolve. What you actually get are these so-called glial Müller cells there, which actually the light comes in here. You've got the nerve stuff there, and then these cells are like funnels with a transparent bit down there, and they interface there with the cells at the back of the eye that detect the light. Now these are like light waveguides, like fibre optic cables that carry the signals to our homes. And they actually, the light from coming through the eye goes into those and is by a process which Steve will understand, the rest of you won't, called total internal reflection of light, it bounces down. Okay? It's the same process where you see glare off a road, you know? Where light can reflect from transparent surfaces if the angle is low enough. That's called total internal reflection. And that's how the light funnels down those glial cells, the Müller cells. And that concentrates the light and means you get a higher intensity at the photoreceptors at the back and obviates the problem of having the nerve cells over the top. It also allows the blue light to seep out. I haven't got time to go into all this, but there's a lot of very interesting articles written about this, about how these Müller cells work, and some quite complex physics, which he lost me in parts from a couple of physicists from Haifa Tech who did some computer simulations of this and this process. Very, very interesting work. But the eye is not wired backwards. It has been designed. It's an engineering design. Designed to have good blood supply at the back, designed to have the nerve cells therefore at the front, and designed with the optical waveguides in, the lossy waveguides, which are necessary, actually. And that's how retina works. So you've got two different kinds of cells at the back of the eye. You've got the so-called rods and cone cells. Okay. I won't go into that because I've not really got time, but that's our retina. Now, that's just another diagram, a nice little diagram of the Müller glial cells there, okay, showing living optical fibres. That's only been discovered in the last couple of decades, if that. Okay, Darwin would never have known about this. Dawkins wouldn't even have known about it when he shot his mouth off a few years ago. I'm sorry, but I get very annoyed when so-called evolutionary scientists say, well, it's a bad design. And I think, yeah, well, so how many eyes have you designed? Well, that's the size of it, isn't it? How dare they, you know, have the cheek to say bad design? Our eye is made from living tissue. It develops from an embryo. It is self-repairing. The optical design is very good, as I will show you in a moment. And even if you stuck a tank gun to Richard Dawkins' head, he could not design an eye. Or any of the other critics. Right. There we are. So many evolutionists, just okay for time, claim the retina of the eye is a very poor design, as the nerve cells, blah, blah, blah. Therefore, God could not have designed it. So the scientific truth is that the back of the eye must have a very good blood supply, the nerves must be at the front of the eye, and the Müller cells overcome this and in fact increase the light gathering capability because they funnel the light down those waveguides. Interesting. Marvellous design. God is far more intelligent than evolutionary biologists. Now, the amazing thing to me is not the optical design of the eye, because that I can understand. What is beyond me, and any scientist, is how the brain analyses the information. It's fantastic. I mean, you've got these two feeds of information coming through. And using that, we in conjunction with our semicircular canals, we have to direct our eyes, focus our eyes, regulate the amount of light going into our eyes, and give us a stereoscopic vision. Our brains create a 3D panorama of the world. Incredible amount of computing power in our heads to create this for our soul or spirit, as it were, to latch onto it and to actually be aware of. But our brains are doing this incredible computation all the time, we're seeing, and automatically regulating what our eyes do. The focusing, the light input, and creating this state for us. It's not just the iris that regulates the light, there are a rest of proteins in the cells at the back of the eye called a resting, believe it or not, which actually alter the sensitivity of the light cells there, which is why when we go into a dark room, momentarily, we can't see a thing. Then after a few seconds or a minute or so, once the eye biochemically has adjusted, then we're sensitive to very low light levels again. And so we've got two means. That's why I said the camera is so bad, because cameras don't adjust the sensitivity of the film or the sensitivity of the CCDs at the back. They just adjust it with an iris. We do, our eyes do both. They adjust the light level by means of the iris, and they adjust it by means of the chemicals in the arrestor proteins actually in the cells at the back of the eye. It gives a massive range of light levels that we can respond to. Right. And see, these are some optical information pathways in the brain. And if something comes towards us, we do that. We don't think about it. All right? We're integrated systems, you see. Integrated system. It's all integrated in the brain. And, you know, this is why I can't believe that any part of it could have evolved. It's such a complex analytical system that controls our vision and integrates it with the rest of our senses and body and what we do. Right. Now, our vision system can do all these things. Just about okay for time. Automatically focus, adjust sensitivity, detect black and white, and perform edge detection, which happens in the retina. Detect full colour information, perform direct with binocular vision, generate a full 3D model of the surroundings inside our head. When we turn, we do not perceive the surroundings as moving in the opposite direction. We think we're moving, and that's the coordination with our semicircular canals, etc. But, you know, we turn around, we don't think the world's moving the other way, we realise that we're moving. It's all integrated. And the retinal image is actually upside down, our brain inverts that for us. And we actually have to have a retinal response time that will stop blurring when things move quickly. The cells have got to reset themselves quickly enough. That's why they've got to have the good blood supply. Otherwise, we just get blur. So when we do that, very quickly, the cells have reset, we refocus very quickly. So in real time, as we move around, we focus on the light cells chemically reset very quickly. They've got to do that probably well within a tenth or even 20th of a second at tops to enable us not just to see a complete blurry mess of the world around us. And the time scales are quite important. And that's one of the reasons the cells have got to be small for their rapid diffusion. They've got to have a good blood supply at the back. In fact, the energy requirements of the cells at the back of the eye are higher than any other cells in the body because of that. Sort of rapid response time necessary. Interesting, isn't it? I bet you didn't realise that. And then, as I said, transfer information quickly to our reflex autonomic system. Now, for the last less than 10 minutes, I'll talk about some of the physical optical design of the eye, which, again, is very interesting. I'll just put this up for fun. Our brain creates for us this three-dimensional scape from what we get in our eyes. But the trouble is, we can fool that system. The computation is very good, but sometimes, like with those optical illusions, we can fool the eye, and that's what they do. And we interpret that, try and interpret three-dimensionally, but if it's drawn peculiarly, we sort of get our brains confused. I like that one, maths and physics. I just think it's interesting. Our brains automatically interpret sometimes 2D information and try and three-dimensionalise it for us. It's an unconscious process, but we can fool those little illusions fool our brains. However, now another little interesting thing is the tear layer. Our eyes are covered, our cornea is covered with a three-layer fluid. It's got some gooey stuff next to the actual cornea, the mucin coacervate. Then it's got some watery stuff, a dilute mucin solution, and then on top, there is a monomolecular layer of an oily stuff. Very, very, very thin, and that's necessary to prevent the mucin solution evaporating too rapidly, and it also helps with anti-reflection. I used to do a little experiment with the students when I was teaching. See that little drop of oil and a tray of water, and put the little drop of oil on the water. And used to a tiniest drop of oil would spread out to a slick, probably about that diameter, on a monomolecular layer. Because the oil molecules, interestingly, they have hydrophilic ends, and they stand up on end, just like meerkats. And you get a little layer of molecules standing on their heads, all across a single molecular layer. And that's what actually happens on our tears, on what covering of our eye. You get a layer, a single molecular film of oil right on the front of the water on our eye. Interesting, isn't it? And that helps prevent evaporation and also has anti-reflection properties. Okay. And that's just something I found on a website about the cornea. Masterfully engineered so that only the most expensive man-made lenses can match its precision. The cornea has to be very, very smooth and correct, optically correct for vision. And that's one of the reasons why it's fluid covered. A, the fluid protects the cornea, stuff can be flushed off. Okay, dirt won't stick to it. Secondly, you've got the reasons that I said before. You've got the anti-reflection properties of that layer, the anti-evaporation of that oil layer. And also, if there are very, very slight irregularities on the corneal surface, the fluid layer will smooth those over and then give an optically completely smooth surface, which is very interesting. So the tear layer over the eye has multiple uses. Right, now, this is more onto my area of expertise, if I have one, and that is about the physical optics of the eye. A lot of computational power and design work in teams goes into the design of cameras, binoculars and telescopes. Designing lens systems is difficult because they all produce what's called aberrations. They don't image perfectly. If you see a kid's pair of binoculars, you'll see why. You get coloured fringes around things and it's blurred at the edges, it's a mess. If you pay £300 or £400 for a pair of binoculars, it's bright and sharp. And that's because of years and years of optical design and trying out things. And all optical systems have aberrations, and the knack is to control them. They don't image perfectly. No optical system can image perfectly. It's physically impossible. All you can do is control the aberrations as best you can. Now, the thing you get on all optical systems are these. And I'll explain what they are. I've just got time, and then we'll finish. So those are the things which plague optical systems. Now, how has the eye been designed to cope with these? Now, the first and most obvious thing that happens with any imaging system is that you get what's called diffraction spread. Now, when waves go through an aperture, they tend to spread out. And a smaller gap spreads more. Now, the upshot of that is, when light is focused by a lens, it doesn't focus down to a point, it focuses down to a disc called an airy disc. The mass of that is quite complex, actually. You get a first-order Bessel function. Stephen knows what that is. The mass is horrible, believe me, to even derive the equation of that. But you get this disc, so you don't get perfect focusing. Whatever lens you use, you will always get a disc there, called diffraction disc or airy disc. Now, how has the eye been designed to cope with this? Well, the diameter of the pupil of our eyes is just large enough so that the diffraction disc is just a bit smaller than the spacing between the sensor cells on the back of the retina. So in fact, the optical design is such that diffraction spread doesn't materially affect our vision. If the eye was smaller, it wouldn't work. If the eye were larger, other aberrations would creep in. So, interesting. Good design. Spherical aberration. Now, spherical lenses image quite badly in some ways. What they do, the peripheral rays actually focus closer than the central rays. You can, a lot of the modern optical equipment has aspheric lenses. You see binoculars particularly, they're advertised, and some cameras have aspherical lenses because of this. Now, the only way to correct this in an optical system is to have a non-spherical lens or to use a second lens to compensate. Our eyes do both. The cornea is not spherical. It produces positive spherical aberration.